Thank you, Carl. It's been very nice that I'm following Mauricio in this symposium, so that the audience is already accustomed to a common interpretation of English. I will start my presentation by discussing about biodiversity in general, because it has been recognized that biodiversity is a key to secure global food supply. And in a recent report of the United Nations, biodiversity has been put in a direct relationship with the right to food. There is a global concern about the reduction of biodiversity. There is a number of estimates of how much diversity has been lost. And the reduction of diversity is also regarding our food. And although there is a large number of species which can be actually eaten, we are only using about 250, but only 15 are providing 90% of our calories, and only 3 are 60% of our calories. And these 3, wheat, rice, and maize, are also globally represented by a relatively small number of varieties. If you look at the evolution of plant breeding that Carl was mentioning in the opening, it's been done by farmers for many, many years, and implicit in the way in which farmers were doing plant breeding was a selection for specific adaptation to their uses and environments, which has led to the formation of land races. When plant breeding started to be done by scientists, this has meant that what was being done by very many people in very many different places started to be done by relatively few people in relatively few places. Selection for specific adaptation was, in most cases, replaced by breeding for wild adaptation and a gradual displacement of land races. And then more recently, most plant breeding has become private, and farmers breeding almost illegal. Almost because actually they can do their breeding, but they cannot exchange the product of their work. Together with all these activities, there's been the accumulation of a large body of local knowledge, not only in developing countries, but also in developed countries. These are some examples from Italy, France, and the US. Where diversity still exists, it exists in the form of different crops in the same farm, in the form of different varieties within the same crop, and in the form of heterogeneous varieties. And in some cases also in the form of mixtures of crops, like the famous barley and wheat mixture in Ethiopia and Eritrea. And farmers are, in some countries, are very proud of their diversity, and they exhibit this diversity in all different ways. We all know that the danger of genetic uniformity, there is an example of UG99 is an additional proof. But why worried? Why worried about diversity, considering that more than 6 million accessions are available in gene banks? Well, while everybody agrees that gene banks are essential, most would agree that not all has been conserved, and gene banks not only freeze seed, but also evolution. And I will come to this point later on. Now, the what I would like to show you is that we think, those who are practicing participatory plant breeding think that it's possible to reconcile making food available for everybody with the maintenance of diversity in what we call participatory plant breeding. There are various definitions of plant breeding, of participatory plant breeding, which to some extent are also related to the definition of who is a plant breeder. And some people have a restricted definition of a plant breeder as a person, a scientist who has the full responsibility of a breeding program, as a cyclic process which goes on for many years. But some people define as a plant breeder also those scientists who contribute with to plant breeding through research, but do not have the responsibility of a breeding program. Now, if you ask these two type of plant breeders a definition of participatory plant breeding, you will get probably two different definitions. Now, for us, participatory prime breeding, and this definition is very similar to what has been given earlier, is a dynamic collaboration. And I underline dynamic because in many places, papers, you will find a rigid classification of type of participation, which doesn't have a proof in the field, because if you practice participatory prime breeding, this is a collaboration between individuals, it evolves with time, and you can go from the predominance of one over the other to a complete change of responsibilities. So if you accept this general scheme of plant breeding as creation of variability, utilization of the variability, and then try the few lines which are coming out from the cycle, partly on station and partly on farm, with the decisions taken by the breeder's team, then a participatory breeding program is exactly the same process. The only difference is that the material goes into farmers' fields earlier, and decisions are shared between the breeder's team and the farmers' community. One definition of participatory prime breeding is of a type of participatory prime breeding is participatory variety selection, which is not very different from the first scheme that I show you. The material goes into farmers' field at a much later stage, but the difference is that the opinion of the farmers becomes part of the evaluation, but only when there are much less choices to be made. Another important difference between participatory plant breeding and conventional plant breeding is that conventional plant breeding is a supply-driven process. I'm invading the field of Mauricio here, where the scientists are producing a product and then give it to the farmers, whether they like it or not. Why in participatory plant breeding, participatory is a demand-driven because the farmers, the clients, the future users are actually involved in the development of the product, in this case, a variety. The general model that we are using with a number of modifications depending on the situation is that the research institute is responsible for generating for a continuous generation of genetic variability, which is then deployed in a number of target environments. These are only four as an example, in a way that different target environment can actually receive a different type of germplasm. Then within each environment, and that's a substantial difference with the traditional plant breeding, selection is done independently in each target environment, with a progressive reduction of the number of lines. And then eventually, from each target environment, you have varieties, which can be different or similar, which flow directly into farmers' fields, but are also recycled into the research institute for another cycle of recombination and selection. Because of the expected larger environmental variability in farmers' field, we spend quite a lot of time in refining experimental design and statistical analysis, so we are using unreplicated or partially replicated designs in row and columns in the first stage when we have a lot of entries. Stage two and stage three, as I mentioned earlier, we are using replicated trials in rows and columns and a simple RBD with farmers' replication in stage four. One substantial difference between conventional and participatory is that in participatory prime breeding, in addition to all the data which are normally collected in breeding trials, we are also collecting the farmer's opinion in a numerical form, which can then be analyzed together with all the other data. And we are mostly using spatial analysis to increase the precision of these trials. And then all these data are compiled. We are also using quite a lot of genotype environment interaction to understand the relationship between location and farmers' fields within locations. All these data, once they've been analyzed, they are properly tabulated in a language which is accessible to farmers, and this is the second and the key meeting with the farmers in which we decide what to select and what to discard, and what we select goes to the next stage. So that scientifically, the two processes are identical with three organizational differences. Most trials are conducted in farmers' fields. This is one of our sites in Eritrea, where we actually have four different crops. The decisions are shared between breeders and farmers. and the process can be duplicated independently in as many locations as you can handle. This is an example of our badly participatory program in Syria, the oldest one. This is where ICARDA is located. The blue are the reserve stations of the Ministry of Agriculture, and the brown are the villages, in each one of which there could be an independent set of germplasm. From an international point of view, one could consider an international center as perhaps the best place to create the genetic variability, and this is what we've been doing in the case of the barley program at ICARDA since the early 90s, in which we are mostly deploying segregating populations to a number of national programs. So now, the addition is that this material, instead of being tested in the reserve stations of the national program, is actually tested and evaluated in farmers' fields. So it's been, this has been superimposed to a structure which was already existing in our case. At this moment, we have projects of this type in Algeria, Egypt, Eritrea, a new one just started in Ethiopia, Yemen. The passport control person was very interested yesterday in the fact that last week I was in Yemen. Jordan, Syria, and Iran on barley, lentil, faba bean, chickpea, and wheat, basically on all the crops on which ICARDA is working. We are giving a lot of importance to women participation. The third author of this presentation is an expert in gender analysis, and the reason is that women often have a knowledge of production processes which is complementary to that of men. Usually they have distinct needs and priorities of traits and crops, and they have a specific interest in food security because they are often in charge of preparing food, and in most developing countries they are the poorest of the poor. So we've developed a method in which if the women cannot come to the field to make selection, we actually bring the crop into the houses to do evaluation of some simple traits. And this is a set of pictures to show how these trials are actually looking in the field. These are the participatory trial in barley in Syria. As you can see, they occupy a relatively small area of about 3,000 square meters. This is a close-up of how the individual plots look like. And then in the second stage, we go for replicated trials and bigger plots. In the third stage, plots are becoming even bigger. And then already in the fourth stage, we can plant big strips, and this could become very close to a commercial crop. But we can also work in much more difficult environments. These are our trials on barley and lentil in the terraces of Yemen, or with different type of plots depending on the farmer way of growing the crop. These are lentil and faba bean in Eritrea, or very small plots because of the small holding, like in this case, bread wheat in Eritrea, in a year in which there was a severe rust epidemic. These chickpea in Syria, barley and durum wheat in Jordan, as you can see the trials within a farmer field. In Iran, we are working in an area where barley is grown under rain-fed conditions. In Iran, there is quite a lot of institutional acceptance of the methodology. This is the Director General of the Office of the Minister of Agriculture in that province. And in the irrigated area east of Tehran, and this picture actually tells you how easy it is to introduce participatory plant breeding in a situation like this. Well, normally, farmers will plant the same variety in all these basins, and when you start a participatory breeding program, you simply put an envelope with a plot number on each of these with a different variety, and there is already a natural grid of rows and columns to do spatial analysis. And this is again barley and durum wheat in Algeria, where we have very large properties. And we're also collaborating with a group doing participatory plant breeding on maize and rice in China. The method is flexible because it can work with different types of agriculture. with different type of crops. You will have some examples from cross-pollinated crops. Can produce any type of variety. This is also important for the registration, because some people believe that for some reason participatory plant breeding can only produce heterogeneous populations, and can also work with different type of farmers, and is also flexible in terms of the role of the partners, as I mentioned before. We had a number of impact. The most important is, of course, variety development. This is just one of the most recent examples in a very dry year in Syria. This is a new variety yielding 71% more than the local variety, and a little bit more of varieties previously adopted by farmers. Institutional, as I mentioned before, a number of institutions are becoming interested in the process. Farmer skills and empowerment is perhaps one of the most dramatic impact. This was obvious in a farmers conference that we organized in Aleppo in 2008. The enhancement of biodiversity, both in space and time, because there is a rapid turnover of varieties. Just to give you an example, only in 2000, in the last cropping season, there have been 9 varieties named and adopted by farmers, and some of which, this one here, for example, has been picked up in 4 different locations, all in the dry areas of Syria. And this is basically coming every year. So that, this, of course, is a consequence when you want to measure the impact of plant breeding in terms of area and number of varieties by using the traditional way of measuring impact, because in a PPB program, very often a variety will never reach thousands and thousands of hectares, because it will be replaced immediately by something better, which is coming with the next cycle. And we have done an economic analysis, which, at least with a program in Syria, which is been the one for which we have more data, would indicate that the benefit of the PPB is nearly 3 times higher than a conventional breeding program. One unexpected impact of the process was an increased interest of farmers in land races. And with the contribution of the Global Trust, we started 2 projects, one in Iran and one in Yemen, and we continue an existing program in Jordan. And we've basically taken material from the gene bank of ICADA for, in the case of Iran, in the case of Jordan, while in the case of Yemen, we've been using 4 different crops and the material which was kept in the local gene bank. And what these 3 projects have in common is that in addition to the evaluation of this material, we are also inviting farmers to see whether we can capture the knowledge that these farmers have of some of these land races that in some cases were considered to be completely lost. In the case of Iran, we found a farmer who has recognized a variety that he was used to grow 50 years ago, and which is considered to be very drought tolerant and is considered to give an optimum bread that we are now bringing back into cultivation. Now, recently, we have been stimulated by the need of producing a methodology to respond quickly to climate changes, to combine participation and evolution, picking up an old concept presented by Sanderson in the 50s on evolutionary plant breeding. And basically what we do, we create a big mixture of either by mixing crosses or varieties and planting them in the target environments. We started with a population of barley obtained by mixing 1,600 F2s, which was planted in a number of different locations affected by different type of stresses. And the idea is that the farmers will simply plant and harvest, and periodically we can extract lines which can feed into the participatory program, and they are expected to be better and better adapted. Last year we started with a similar population of durum wheat, a little bit less complex, and at this moment we are distributing a new population of bread wheat. This is the durum wheat population being increased in Algeria. Now, as Carl mentioned before, variety release systems and seed laws are the main problems that we are trying to get around with by encouraging local seed production, by providing farmers with simple machines to clean and treat the seed. And so these are some examples from Syria, Jordan, again Syria, and Eritrea, of PPB varieties being multiplied, or in this case, grown by farmers. Now, the idea of this presentation was to show you that ideally, institutions could do plant breeding in a way that, although working at the level of individual farmers, can still address some major global issues such as food security, climate changes, biodiversity, and seed production. And being a highly decentralized process, participatory plant breeding can produce varieties which are different from country to country, from village to village, and within the same village. And is in this moment, even also in Europe, is organic breeders are becoming particularly interested because it seems to fit to their needs. And thank you very much.